Before the episode begins, we'd like to tell you about Impulse, meeting health pioneers. Impulse is the podcast where you will discover the latest advances in the medical field through conversations with the brightest minds changing how care is delivered. From the rehabilitation of paraplegics having lost the ability to walk, to revolutionary contraception methods for men, the podcast covers current and future wonders of medicine that are or will be transforming healthcare. Your host, Mathieu Chaffard, eagerly awaits you, so don't hesitate and go listen to fascinating episodes about medical advancements. You are listening to Science for Care. I am Anka Petre, and this show unveils the stories behind some of the most important scientific and medical breakthroughs of our time. Episode 2, When Medicine Discovered Women's Health. We've all heard the expression the weaker sex, usually used when describing women. Well, this expression is in fact a reflection of hundreds of years during which society considered women as more fragile, more prone to sickness, and ultimately, weaker. Hundreds of years during which time women's physical and psychological health was dismissed. In today's episode, I will take you on a bumpy journey through history into the difficulties and obstacles women faced before modern medicine finally took them into consideration. The idea that women are weaker than men dates all the way back to antiquity. At that time, women were seen as failed derivatives of men. Their body was not as strong and enduring as that of their male counterparts. This vision had a direct impact on science and medicine for centuries. Muriel Salles, a French historian specialized in women's history, will accompany us on today's journey to share her thoughts and knowledge on this topic.
Well, I'm considering this issue of women's health from the emergence of modern medicine, and that is the second half of the 18th century. For a number of reasons, a very depreciative medical discourse is then developed about women. The main challenge is to define a female nature that is deeply different from the male nature, which is considered, in fact, as the human nature. And I think it's a kind of strategy. Thanks to French Revolution and to the philosophy of Enlightenment, it's now accepted that individuals have natural rights. Thanks to the French Revolution and to the philosophy of Enlightenment, it's now accepted that individuals have natural rights, which means that they have rights because of their humanity and that these rights are intangible. According to this idea, if you consider women as humans, you're forced to admit that they can claim the same rights as men. But as you perhaps know, the French Revolution did not keep its promise on this point. To justify the exclusion of women, a coherent discourse is needed. Human nature gives rights to humanity. Female nature deprives women of rights. And physicians actively participate to build this discourse. That's why, as you said, the expression, the weaker sex, is then forcefully documented in medical publications. Thus considered, the nature of women makes them inherently vulnerable, and hundreds of pages are written about female anatomy and about this anatomy failing by nature, and hundreds of pages are written on female diseases, and that's why there are so many publications about women's health. But that's also why these publications are ambiguous. If women are eternally sick, if they are, as I like to say, physiologically pathologic, how can you distinguish the normal from the pathological? And to give an example, how will you draw the line between normal menstrual pain and endometriosis-related suffering?
It wasn't until the 19th century that the first attempts were made at relieving pain during childbirth. Normalizing pain in women, especially when it comes to childbirth, has long been anchored in our societies, traditions, and cultures. For years, it was also considered natural for women to suffer during their periods. Some even said it was a sign they were fertile. On the other hand, pain in men was never seen as normal and was therefore usually treated quickly. Another example is that of psychology. During the 17th and 18th centuries, symptoms such as hot flushes or dizziness were considered nervous conditions when experienced by women, who were believed to be more emotional and unable to control their feelings. As a matter of fact, all the behaviors condemned by society, such as high sexual appetite, were attributed to nervous conditions when it came to women. Of course, the same behaviors were usually considered normal in men. These biases can still be found in our modern society, particularly in the workplace. Ambitious, opinionated, and daring women are often considered too loud, too careerist, and too dominant, whereas these same traits in men usually make them appreciated and respected colleagues.
When it comes to women's health, we think, in fact, to reproductive health, and it's very restrictive. First of all, I think it's related to the fact that for a long time, pregnancies and deliveries are central events in women's lives. Perhaps we must remember here that for a long time, women did not control their fertility. We must remember that they had neither the medical means nor the right to do so. And these events are therefore essential in the lives of women, especially since they are likely to go wrong. And in fact, they went wrong quite often. In the 18th century, maternal mortality was estimated about 1% of women died in childbirth at each birth. So the more children you give birth to, the greater risk of dying you have. But moreover, being a mother is the social role and the destiny of women according to the mentalities of these times. Their life is dedicated to their kids. Their body is dedicated to give birth. There's an article, Woman, in the Encyclopedia of Diderot et d'Alembert, and in which we can read that the woman's pelvis is wide and curved to contain the fetus. We can read that her tissues and her fibers are flexible to expand and wrap the fetus. We can read that the sternum of women is chiseled to let through the vessel of the breast, which is conveniently placed so that the human mother can see and caress her child by nourishing him. So there's a conclusion, and I quote, all these facts prove that the woman's destination is to have children and to feed them. And even if things change, and even if the situation is very different today, we struggle to pass that. And when we think about feminine health issues, we think about reproductive health issues, period, pregnancies, menopause. When we think about feminine organs, we think about womb, ovaries, breast. And to give an example, feminine cancers are identified as an issue for women's health. But we rarely know that the main cause of mortality for women is cardiovascular disease. Even if women are far more than their womb, when it comes to women's health issues, we always think about reproductive health.
Did you know that the first time we considered rethinking medicine and research based on gender was in the 80s in the US? Up until then, women were not even included in medical research. In 1977, the American Food and Drug Administration recommended excluding women with childbearing potential from clinical drug trials because of previous incidents affecting them. In other words, studying men was just considered much easier and exposed researchers to fewer risks. This led to totally absurd situations, like a study about the link between obesity and breast and uterine cancer conducted on men.
Medicine is an androcentric scientific discipline in its discourses and in its practices. This is what feminist criticism of knowledge has shown since the 1970s. Since the middle of the 20th century, the action of feminist movements for women's health, in the United States first, but then in Europe, this action has made biomedical research and the clinic evolve. The women's health movement organizes a struggle for the right to contraception and abortion. But more broadly, feminist movement criticizes the way knowledges are produced that make women exception to the norm. A man is the norm and woman is the exception. And they also denounce practices that consider women only as passive in the singular relationship which exists between them and those who take care of them, that means physicians. So feminist movements defend the idea that being a woman is a way of being a human being, a legitimate way, not a secondary or a degraded way. They take a positive look at women's bodies. They underline the fact that giving birth is a huge strength, a huge power, and not a malediction. Thus, it's legitimate for them to relieve pain during childbirth, for example. But they also underline that even if giving birth is a superpower women have, it's not their only role, not their only expectation. And this new way of thinking about women's health opens new horizons for research and for practices.
The strong inequality in the way science and medicine approached women accumulated over the years and has left significant deficiencies in our modern health systems. For one, we still have a lot of blind spots when it comes to women's health because they were left out of medical research for such a long time. Without reliable data, it is complicated to adapt care, personalize treatment plans, and ensure prevention. These gaps also extend to clinical practice. Some diseases, such as heart attacks, are still considered men's diseases and are therefore underdiagnosed in women. Yet, women are now known to be more vulnerable to cardiovascular conditions. The good news is that in just a couple of years, we have come a long way in bridging the gap between the way men and women receive care. To continue these efforts, the French High Council on Equality formulated 40 recommendations along four main lines. First, raising awareness among healthcare providers about the interactions between sex, gender, and pathologies. Second, supporting multidisciplinary research on sex and gender in health. Third, taking better account of living conditions and the environment in health inequality. And fourth, training current and future care professionals and ensuring that women have access to positions of responsibility in the public hospital service and the research sector.
In fact, sex and gender are not always being understood by the medical community. And especially in France, it's not easy to speak about that. For many caregivers, physicians or nurses, when you say that male-centric medicine endangers women's health, it's an attack, but it's not my goal, of course. And what I say is caregivers do not endanger their patients intentionally. They work with knowledges. They have practices that are partial and ignorant of the specificities of women and minorities. So as I always say, to improve health care for both men and women, we need sex and we need gender. Gender is this concept that refers to socially constructed characteristics of women and men, such as norms, roles, and relations between groups of women and men. These norms vary from society to society and evolve over time. They are often upheld and reproduced in the values, legislation, education systems, religion, media, and other institutions of the society in which they exist. But when individuals or groups do not fit established gender norms, they often face stigma or discriminatory practices and social exclusion. So gender reflects unequal relations of power, producing inequalities that intersect with other social and economical inequalities. And of course, all these things affect health. Gender interacts with sex, but it's different from it. The two terms are distinct and should not be used interchangeably. Sex refers to a set of biological attributes in humans and animals. Taking sex and gender into account when delivering care means two things. First, an evidence. Your biology allows you to escape certain health problems. Women are spared prostate cancer. However, most health conditions affect both men and women in varying degrees and in varying ways. In some cases, doctors don't have a ready explanation for why certain diseases are more common in one sex than in another. But in others, doctors will tell you complicated genetic, physiological, hormonal, and social factors are at work. And here, it's the main idea. There is a relationship of social and political inequalities between men and women in the field of medically dominated health services. Part of it can be explained because men and women are biologically different. It's sex differences. But part of it is related to inequalities between men and women, which are numerous and documented. Wage inequalities, different exposure to violence, to sexist and sexual violence especially. And part of it is due to differences in behavior and in education between men and women. And that's why gender is useful to understand women's health issues.
The fight for women's rights takes many shapes and forms. In medicine and science, we have not yet reached perfect equality in the way men and women are considered. Many biases inherited from years of believing that women are just less functional versions of men still exist today. Taking into account sex and gender when delivering care is a necessity to address women's needs and break the vicious cycle of exclusion. Today's story is perhaps one of the most important our societies will ever learn. It is the story of equal rights, equal consideration, and equal opportunities for half of the global population. This story is not yet over. This story is ours to continue writing. Science for Care is a podcast by Health Tech for Care, a nonprofit organization designed to support and promote access to care for all. If you enjoy our show, please mention it to your friends, family, and coworkers, and leave ratings and reviews on your favorite listening platform.